It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll set aside the dinosaur glory hounds for a minute. That means you, T-Rex, and spend some time with the unsung heroes of the dinosaur world.
But first, a proposal to change state employee health benefits could be gaining momentum in the state.
According to the Wisconsin State Journal, Governor Walker is meeting with health plan executives today about the possibility of moving from a competitive HMO model to a self-insured program.
Joining us now to explain is one of the authors of that story, David Wahlberg. He's the health and medicine reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. David, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, good to be here.
So did you see this story coming? Was it a surprise for you?
Well, actually, this proposal to switch from the competitive managed care model that the state has used for several years to the self-insured model has been out there for about a year, but it hasn't gotten much attention until recently. And then the fact that the governor met today with some of the heads of the health plans seemed to indicate that it was certainly being taken seriously.
So the governor met today with some of the heads of these health plans. Do you know what happened at that meeting?
I don't. I haven't heard much about what the result of that meeting was.
So in general, how does the HMO model in Wisconsin currently work for state employees?
Right. So there are about 18 HMOs that are available at different parts of the state. So not all of them are available everywhere. But employees in different locations have choices of a few of those. Basically, they pay part of the premium, and then the state picks up the rest. And the idea is that the competition between the HMOs, for example, there are four HMOs that compete quite a bit in Dane County for that business, drives down the rates and theoretically keeps them low for the state.
And so then how would a self-insurance plan work?
Right. So with self-insurance, the state doesn't contract with insurance companies for insurance. It basically pays the bills itself. And as part of that, the state is basically accepting the risk for any really large claims that might be filed. So in some years, that might be a good thing if your costs are low and people don't have a lot of large claims. Perhaps you can save money. But in those years where people get really sick and require lots of expensive treatment, you might potentially lose money. There is some stopgap insurance that can be bought to sort of buffer that, but that would add to the expense.
Do you know how this would affect, you know, people and their pocketbooks?
That's kind of unclear right now. So there's been a couple studies out by Deloitte, the consulting firm, and the most recent one was in August, and it essentially said that going to self-insurance could save about 4 to 5%, partly by avoiding some of the taxes from the Affordable Care Act, or I should say fees from the Affordable Care Act. But the same report says that the current system saves about 4 to 5%. So, you know, that might suggest it would be sort of a wash for the state and for employees. Basically, the report suggested that the Group Insurance Board, which oversees this program for state employees, should really gather some more data, and it might be possible that this could save money, at least in some regions of the state.
Now, it sounds like there are about 20 other states that already follow this self-insurance plan, and I wonder if you have any idea about how they're faring with it.
I don't. That's something I've been trying to get some time to look at and just haven't really had a chance to. I did find out, for example, that our neighbor to the west, Minnesota, does this, but I don't know much about what the result has been.
So what has been the reaction so far to this?
Well, I don't know. I guess, you know, we've gotten quite a few comments on our story online, for example. But other than that, I don't know much about the reaction. I've been sort of busy with other stories today.
Do you have any idea what people said in those comment sections? Anything worth repeating?
No. No, not that I can think of.
You know, you said this is a story that has been out there for a while. Now, how come it seems like it's really first breaking today if it's been out there?
Right. So the Walker administration has been looking at this idea for well over a year, and the initial report from Deloitte came out in October of 2012, although I don't think people really knew about it until early this year. And then it was this January that essentially a second report was requested to look further at this. And that's when I started hearing about it from some health plans. But it was sort of unclear how serious this proposal was, at least to me, until we heard about the meeting today.
Now, would you say this is a neutral sort of cost-saving venture that Governor Walker is looking into right now? Or is this a way of, you know, maybe a state thumbing its nose at the Affordable Care Act?
Yeah, I can't really, you know, it's hard for me to decide about that. Certainly, you know, it was interesting that the meeting happened to happen today on the day that the exchanges are open. But, and certainly part of the reason, part of the motivation for doing this, according to these reports, is to avoid that fee from the Affordable Care Act. But, you know, obviously 20 other states have done this, and presumably several of them did this long before the law was passed. So, you know, that's not the only motivation to do it. You can theoretically save some administration costs, too. So, you know, it might be something for states to look at.
David, do you know what the timeline is for this and what we might expect to happen next?
Yeah, so a committee of the Group Insurance Board, which oversees this, is likely going to take up a piece of this October 11th. And the recommendation to them from this consultant is that they request more formal proposals from companies that would help administer this kind of program. And then there would be more sort of hard data to go on to see if indeed this really could save money in certain parts of the state.
All right. Well, so, David, thank you so much for joining us today.
Okay. Well, thank you.
We've been talking to David Wahlberg, the health and medicine reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal.
Coming up next, we'll take a look at the unsung heroes of the dinosaur world. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, Rob, you're thinking about dinosaurs.
Right.
What image pops into your head?
I'm probably like a lot of folks, you know, a T-Rex, maybe a Brontosaurus, you know, submerged in a lake.
So predictable, Ferret.
Yeah. Well, what about you?
Same thing.
Yeah. Predictable.
Well, our next guest says science has actually learned a lot more from less famous dinosaurs. He calls them the unsung heroes of the dinosaur world.
Brian Sweetek is with us now. He's a science writer and blogger. He's the author of My Beloved Brontosaurus, On the Road with Old Bones, New Science, and Our Favorite Dinosaurs. We've got an article he wrote linked on our Facebook page. Brian, welcome to the show.
I'm glad to be here.
So first, how did T-Rex get to be the rock star of the dinosaur world?
Well, in a way, it sort of was from the very beginning. I mean, first of all, Tyrannosaurus Rex, that would be one of the best names ever coined in the history of science. It's incredibly evocative. It was named in 1905 by Henry Fairfield Osborne. The following year, the American Museum of Natural History was starting to put up a second skeleton. The second one is a more complete one that had been found in Montana. They only had the hips and the legs put up. And the New York Times ran this article saying it was the prize fighter of antiquity, and you know, nothing had ever been so fierce and so wonderful. So before people even really saw what this dinosaur was, just the fact that it was this giant carnivore bigger than anything that had ever been seen just established it as the, you know, killer dinosaur of all time, and it's just had a cultural momentum ever since then. Basically, it got into museums first and was really famous, and nothing has really been able to overshadow its reputation.
Got there first and good press. And now what about the other one we mentioned, the Brontosaurus? As I understand it, that's not even a real thing anymore.
Yeah, about the time that Tyrannosaurus was going up at the AMNH, Brontosaurus was scientifically dead. A paleontologist by the name of Elmer Riggs actually figured out that the dinosaur known as Brontosaurus should properly be called Apatosaurus. That is basically a double name. It was a synonym for one that had been named a few years earlier. But for whatever reason, it just stuck in museum halls. When museums put up their own skeletons of this, you know, long-necked dinosaur properly called Apatosaurus, they used the old name. for reasons that aren't entirely clear. And because that was there and because it became a kind of shorthand for the public, you know, Brontosaurus stayed on for decades in the public imagination until they found the long-lost skull of Apatosaurus in the late 1970s. The big image change finally happened. But yeah, I mean, that was, it's basically a dinosaur zombie just kind of shuffling along in museum halls until this correction was made.
Is it a thing like when they said Pluto's not a planet? Did we have a lot of very upset kids around the country clinging to the Brontosaurus?
See, that's the outcry that I've seen are actually from adults and people of my generation, and not so much. I mean, kids love it. Kids actually love the fact, like, you know, Pluto's not a planet anymore. They love to show up, adults. They love to show us up in terms of, you know, how they're really on point. It's mostly, like, a few years ago in 2010, there was a proposal that a dinosaur called Torosaurus, this three-horned, large, frail dinosaur, was the adult form of Triceratops. And Triceratops was named first. So if this was true, if Torosaurus really was the adult form of our favorite Triceratops, and Triceratops would remain the name. But there's this huge public outcry, this huge misunderstanding, thinking that paleontologists were going to take Triceratops away. And people were comparing it to Pluto, saying this is just Pluto and Brontosaurus all over again, when really that wasn't anything at all to worry about. So I think, if anything, it's us who remember our childhood dinosaurs, remember the dinosaurs that we grew up with, that get most upset about this.
Well, the piece you wrote that prompted us giving you a call is about the dinosaurs that maybe aren't the household names that we've learned a lot from. And let's just go through them in the order of how hard they are to pronounce. And if we run out the clock, I won't have to say the really hard ones. Myasaura. What have we learned from Myasaura?
Well, that dinosaurs might be good parents. I mean, Myasaura translates to, you know, caring mother lizard, and that was one of the sort of iconic aspects of this animal that was found in the late 1970s, is that it wasn't just the single skeleton or even fragments of a skeleton those paleontologists so often find. It's this vast nesting ground. You know, contain not only eggshell, but, you know, hatchlings, infants, all the way up through adults. And previously, dinosaurs were thought to be kind of, well, basically poor parents. They just laid the eggs and they left them and kind of left nature sorted out. This was really good evidence, especially based upon the sort of development of the juveniles, that dinosaurs were, you know, attentive and caring parents, at least early in the lives of their offspring. You know, this major image shift, and, you know, the dinosaur got a little bit of fame. I remember a children's book about it, but, you know, sort of things like The Layer Land Before Time and other sort of films where we see the caring parent dinosaurs, that's based off of Myasaura.
And the previous thought, as you mentioned, was that dinosaurs are kind of fire and forget with their eggs. They dropped them, moved on, hope for the best.
Yeah. I mean, that still seems like it might be the case for some. Not all dinosaurs are exactly the same. I mean, we're dealing with, you know, over 1,000 different genera of animals over millions and millions of years, but at least raise the possibility that dinosaurs weren't as crummy parents as had always been believed.
Well, it seems like over time, as we find more and more fossils and fossil evidence, the story keeps getting more and more complicated as we see more dinosaurs. Obviously, there must have been diversity in their behavior, their appearance, everything about them.
Absolutely, just like the modern world today. I mean, there are lizards that live in the American Southwest that are entirely different species, but they're geographically sort of differentiated in different colors. So it's things that are that subtle that must have existed among dinosaurs as well. I mean, there are over 50 skeletons of the dinosaur that we call T-Rex going over 2 million years of history. Chances are, if we could see the living animals, if we could see them, you know, really biologically and not just with the fossil record, there might have been multiple species. They might have been differentiated by color or certain things of behavior, but we can't quite get it. That we just have the bones. But even with just the bones, you know, differentiating one species from another on the basis of, you know, anatomy, different kinds of dinosaurs that we never knew existed before, it's really, you know, it's changing in an extremely rapid clip. I mean, a new dinosaur is named, I think, on the average of every 2 weeks.
Wow.
And most of them are as yet undiscovered. So really, we're still just getting to know what dinosaurs were, much less their biology.
Well, let's get to some of the other unsung heroes. Correct me on the pronunciation, Deinonychus?
Yeah. That one, there's a couple of variations, but that was the inspiration for Velociraptor in Jurassic Park. So Deinonychus, I guess, is the way that I usually go with it. Deinonychus also works. But this is a dinosaur that stood about as tall as, you know, the average human. It had this really distinctive switchblade claw on its foot and totally changed the image of what a dinosaur could be. This was dinosaurs found in 1969 in Montana. And at that time, dinosaurs were still kind of slow and stupid. neglected and swamp-bound and relatively drab and all that interesting. They were seen as basically larger variations of lizards, which were seen as basically as boring little reptiles. So Deinonychus, when this was discovered by paleontologist John Ostrom out of Yale, he immediately saw this could not be a slow-moving, stupid animal. It had to be active. It had all the anatomical hallmarks of an animal that was actively running down prey, probably had a hot running metabolism, was very bird-like, and provided the idea, now fact, that birds are dinosaurs. So this was really, if there's any singular dinosaur that totally changed the image of what a dinosaur was and sort of ushered in the modern image of dinosaurs, it would be Deinonychus.
And with that metabolism you mentioned, does that mean they were what we lay people would call warm-blooded?
Yeah, or at least much more like birds, which are living dinosaurs and mammals like us, than the traditional image of sort of lizards and snakes and crocodiles. For a long time, dinosaurs were just seen as larger versions of the small reptiles we see around us today. But even though sort of many things about their physiology are still a mystery, all the hallmarks that paleontologists have been able to sort of pull out of their bones point to animals that must have had some way of being incredibly fast-growing, maintaining a high and active body temperature, being, they said, much more like, you know, birds and their living dinosaurian descendants than anything that researchers expected before.
All right, another species you mentioned, Hadrosaurus?
Yeah, Hadrosaurus, that one's from my old home state of New Jersey, one of the most important dinosaurs ever found and often sort of overlooked because there's not very much of it. It was found before New Jersey kind of paved over all its fossil sites, which is a rather unfortunate thing. One of the last ones remaining is actually behind a Target off a highway, and that's the only one left from this particular era. But Hadrosaurus is one of these large herbivorous shovel-beaked hadrosaurs. It gave its name to the entire group, similar to Mayasaura. And it was one of the first dinosaurs known from a partial skeleton. Previously, all the bones that had been found in the early to mid-19th century were just, you know, scraps of jaw, a tooth here or there, a couple limb bones, and these were all put into sort of the form of iguanas or crocodiles or other familiar reptiles. Paleontologists could tell that these were from some kind of reptile, but they had no clue what the whole thing looked like, so they kind of just made their best guess based upon living reptiles. Hadrosaurus showed that dinosaurs were something unique and totally different, and, you know, in this particular case, the Hadrosaurus had shorter forelimbs than hind limbs, so it changed sort of ideas about posture and how they walked and how they moved, that they weren't sort of sprawling and squatting on the ground, but walking with this erect gait, and sort of was the first move to what we would consider sort of the modern image of the dinosaur.
All right, here's the one I was fearing, Cynoceropteryx.
You did very good. Yeah, so Cynoceropteryx. This is a little sort of chicken-sized dinosaur, and the amazing thing about it, the greatest thing, that is that it's fuzzy. It has this sort of almost mane of protofeathers running down its back. So I meant we were talking about Deinonychus a moment ago. John Ostrom and other paleontologists, on the basis of just the bones, say these dinosaurs are very, very bird-like. Maybe birds are dinosaurs. And one of the missing bits was, well, where are the feathers if birds were dinosaurs? Feathers probably evolved sometime amongst the dinosaurs. If this connection is real, where are they? Well, in 1996, Cynoceropteryx shows up and confirms that connection. It was really the beginning of this flood of feathery fossils coming out of China and elsewhere around the world. And the amazing thing about this is, beyond sort of confirming the bird-dinosaur connection, showing that, you know, many of them were covered in fluff and fuzz and feathers and these really weird body coverings, is that it gives us a way to finally discover dinosaur color by zooming in on these fossilized feathers and comparing them to the feathers of modern birds. Paleontologists can reconstruct what colors these dinosaurs were. And as a kid, I was always told we never ever knew that. So, you know, beyond just changing the image, it's literally changing sort of the art and the visions that we have of these animals.
So in our last minute or so, for these things that were around 65 million years ago and longer, they're changing every darn day. Why? That's got to be exciting to watch.
Oh, absolutely. It's incredibly fluid and dynamic science. And every time someone comes up with an idea, someone might dispute that or come up with another explanation or something like that. So really finding dinosaurs, the sort of Indiana Jones stuff that, you know, we love and I love to volunteer to do out in the field, that's just the beginning. Finding dinosaurs is just step one. And we're finding more and more from the remains than ever before. And every day, that's changing our image of what dinosaurs are really like.
Brian, thanks a lot for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was Brian Switek. He's a science writer, author of My Beloved Brontosaurus. We have a link to the article he wrote about the unsung dinosaur heroes. You can find it at our Facebook page. That's Central Time on WPR.
Rob, were you actually trying to walk like a dinosaur during
that
interview?
I was. I was kind of like, they thought they waddled this way, but then they learned they walk upright.
Yeah, that's what
I
saw.
That was it.
All right, we'll post video of that tomorrow. Well, speaking of tomorrow, coming up tomorrow on Central Time, Dr. Neil Barnard joins the show to share advice on nutrition and brain health.
On a related note, we'll hear about the novel cure, what novels to read when we're feeling sick, sad, or out of sorts.
And we'll get a look at college football. Our guest tackles the glories and scandals of the sport.
That's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.
Coming up after the news, UW-Madison was rated the number 2 party school in the nation, but a lot of people aren't celebrating. They say the rating puts the spotlight on a problem of college binge drinking. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll get nostalgic over what might be the coolest school supply of all time, the Trapper Keeper.
But first, the University of Wisconsin-Madison was recently named the number 2 party school in the nation by Playboy magazine. And while some are cheering that designation, others point to the serious consequences alcohol use can have among students.
It's a problem that's plagued UW-Madison, colleges around the state and country for years. The college drinking culture seems to be alive and well, but what's being done to try and tackle it?
Joining us now is Dr. Sarah Van Orman, Executive Director of University Health Services at UW-Madison. Dr. Orman, welcome to the show. Dr. Orman, are you with us? We have the guest, and we are just going to try to get her on the line. I know that she is there with us. We're working on it. Well, how about in the meantime, what do you think about college drinking culture? Does this come as good news to you that UW-Madison is getting some recognition, or are you worried about this? And let's see if we have Dr. Orman with us. Are you there, Dr. Orman?
Yes. Can you hear me okay?
I can. Excellent. Thank you so much for your patience.
No problem.
Well, as we mentioned, the UW was recently named the number 2 party school in the country. And from your perspective, what do you think about that designation?
I think it doesn't, unfortunately, it doesn't really represent the experience of a lot of students at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I think that when we think about that designation, often what we're thinking about is a culture that's associated with really high-risk alcohol use. And that's unfortunately something that causes our students a lot of harm. What we do know is that most of what our students love about being here is being with friends, the great education they get, all the activities they are involved in. So we try to celebrate those things rather than a culture of excessive alcohol use.
So do you have to attack sort of both of those prongs at the same time, excessive alcohol use and, you know, accentuating different positive stuff?
Yeah, I think that's what we try to do. I mean, we certainly know that alcohol and high-risk alcohol use is a major public health problem on our campus, as it is on many campuses. And we know that that's associated with really serious harm for our students. And unfortunately, it also gets in the way of what the good parts and why they're here, which is getting a good education, moving on with their lives. So we really do try to focus on both of those things.
How big of a problem would you say that alcohol is, and in specific binge drinking at UW college campuses?
It unfortunately is a really significant problem. We typically think about problematic alcohol use, as you said, is sort of binge drinking, and that is sort of consuming enough alcohol quickly enough that people reach a point of intoxication where they're going to become incapacitated. We know that probably on the UW-Madison campus among undergraduates, around 60% or so, and that number changes some over time, of students report binge drinking, at least occasionally, and maybe a quarter of students report more frequent binge drinking, sort of a few times, three times within a 2-week period. That number is higher than what we see nationally at institutions of higher ed, and it actually is a little higher than even what we see within the system schools.
Well, the college drinking culture isn't necessarily unique to UW-Madison, but do you think that being in Wisconsin sort of amplifies the problem, seeing, you know, as, you know, according to a lot of what we read and hear, drinking culture is so ingrained in the state's culture?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. So we, I think sometimes in Madison we have a little bit of a perfect storm around high-risk alcohol use, in that we certainly know that it is something associated with campuses, with institutions of higher ed. But we also are in the state that on most measures of alcohol misuse ranks number one in the nation. So we're in this culture and this state where alcohol consumption is higher and high-risk alcohol consumption is higher. And then we certainly know that the we're sort of in this environment, and Madison is a little bit of a draw for other people to come to our community. For example, one of the things that we know is that when we look at kind of, you know, arrests and those things around our campus, many times we have actually students coming from out of state, from other campuses to Madison to engage in some of this high-risk alcohol use. So we're a draw.
Well, when you look at things like TV shows and movies, it sort of seems like that is the default position. Kids go to college and they party and they drink a lot. And a lot of those scenes are shot as funny, that people are drinking really hard and drinking a lot and the sort of mayhem that ensues. Is that part of the problem here, the way that we sort of perceive the college years?
Absolutely. And I'm so glad that you brought up that point, that we find ourselves even sometimes, you know, it's sort of, you know, laughing about it, kind of the classic, you know, Animal House kind of picture, that this is kind of what college is about, is consuming alcohol. And not just consuming alcohol and being with your friends and having a good time, but consuming alcohol really in the kind of more is better, to the point of an incapacitation, to the point of behaviors that are harmful, that really is seen as sort of funny or a joke. And I think that's the thing we really need to change. Because the numbers about the consequences of that, the short and long term, are actually pretty staggering.
Tell us about some of those consequences. What are they?
So I think when we look at it, first of all, looking at our own campus, we know that about a third of our students on this campus report some sort of an academic consequence from that. So missing classes, doing poorly in their coursework. So really pretty high numbers. Nationally, we know that there's probably around 2,000 students that actually die from alcohol poisoning or overdose. You know, 600,000 injuries, 100,000 cases of sexual assault. So those are pretty large numbers. On our campus, you know, we have a few 100 to 150 students who go to detox every year. And so those are numbers that both are a real impact to that individual student, as well as to our community.
So what kinds of things is the UW system doing to address, you know, the drinking culture on campus?
So some of the things that we're working on are a variety of different programs. One of the things when we think about effective alcohol policy, it's really important to remember there isn't sort of one thing that you can do. You have to have a multiple strategies at once, and you have to have strategies that work at every level. So we think about really talking about, we have to have things that work at the individual student level, that work at the sort of group level, that work at the institutional level, and then work at the community level. And if you work on any one of those levels without the other, you're probably not going to be effective. So some of the things we've done recently at UW-Madison is just this fall, we've implemented for the first time alcohol education for all incoming students.
And this is mandatory?
It is mandatory, yeah. Well, it's required this year. In subsequent years, we'll actually be placing a hold on students' registration for it. But at this point, as of about a week ago, we have over 90% of incoming students have completed it. It really provides good education for students, as well as personalized feedback on how they're drinking now. So we're really hopeful that over a period of time, that may make a difference.
And what else?
Other things we've done in the last few years, we are also working, we implemented 2 years ago a program called Basics, which, again, works for students after they've had difficulty scum. So a student who might have been taken to detox or had an encounter with our police department or our housing staff are required to complete this program, really, that has some evidence behind it suggesting that works with students using, you know, evidence-based methods to try to prevent them from ever being in that situation again. We also are, you know, excited to partner with our community around some of the other community strategies that may be helpful in this.
So what kind of response are you getting from students? Does it seem like a drag to them, especially those incoming students who are getting this alcohol edu? Or do you think you're actually getting somewhere?
I think, you know, I think we're very hopeful with it. Our students have been involved in the selection of the product that we're using. Our student government has been very supportive of this. I think students don't want to be in an environment where alcohol impacts them and impacts the culture and the climate of where they are. They don't want the safety issues. They don't want the injuries. So students have actually been great partners in these efforts.
We're talking with Dr. Sarah Van Orman about the college drinking culture in Wisconsin and beyond, and we want to hear from you. What do you think colleges should be doing to address the drinking culture, and what do you think about it viewed as sort of a particular problem that Wisconsin seems to have with drinking culture? You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or send us an email to talk@WPR.org. We'll get to your calls after the break.
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. We're continuing our discussion now with Dr. Sarah Van Orman about binge drinking on college campuses, and we want to hear from you.
Well, what do you think can be done to address the college drinking culture? And curious about what's going on your campus. If you're in college, do you see the binge drinking that you might expect, given a number two party designation at UW-Madison? And do you think there is this idea out there that you have to party, that you have to drink a lot to have fun in college? Is it true? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And we go to the phones now. We've got Steve joining us from Menominee. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
What do you think?
I'm a physician in Menominee, Wisconsin. We're a college town with UW-Stout, so I see a lot firsthand of some of the drinking issues we have in Wisconsin. I guess I have two comments. One is that, you know, we'll sometimes see kids going out on their 21st birthday at midnight and drinking till bar close at 2 a.m., which is quite dangerous practice. I have a daughter going to college in North Dakota, and I mentioned that to her when she turned 21, and she says, well, don't be silly. I wouldn't do that. That's also not allowed in North Dakota. Shouldn't that be one simple measure we could take?
What do you mean? I'm curious that it's not allowed. Not at the 21-year-old age, or what is it? What is it that's
not
allowed?
Yeah, they don't allow them. They can't drink at midnight when they turn 21.
Oh.
Whereas in Wisconsin, yeah, that 21 birthday, you can start drinking at midnight, and then when bar closes at 2, you try to drink as much as you can during that 2-hour window.
Oh, I gotcha. Okay.
So, oh. I mean, in North Dakota, they'd have to wait till the next day.
All right. And you're up at the UW-Stout campus. Do you see, you know, a culture like this, especially maybe as you talk to your daughter about what it's like in Nebraska? Does she sort of report back on that same kind of culture?
Sorry, I couldn't quite catch the question.
Just wondering if how Wisconsin compared as a drinking culture to where your daughter is at a different school, a different state.
Yeah, it seems to be quite a bit different. I know when I went to her orientation, you know, they kind of made a big deal about drinking, and they said, we expect you, if you choose to drink responsibly. If you get into legal difficulty, you will come to the school and answer your school administrators and try to explain to us why you should stay in school. This is at University of North Dakota in Grand Forks. Mm. They seem to take a pretty more strict approach from the college standpoint than I've seen in Wisconsin.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Steve. And what do you think about some of those things that Steve had to say, Dr. Van Orman?
Well, I think those are really good points. I think his comment about the 21 is really important. We actually, nationally, there's it's actually very much of a risk factor, and there's campuses that have tried to do things about targeting students, but a number of highly publicized cases and some evidence of students dying actually on their 21st birthday because of exactly what the kinds of behaviors he's describing. So I think, though, what he's talking about with things about like the laws is there are some really effective policy things and things that we can do to address those sorts of things. So that's a great example of a kind of a law or regulation that really targets what we know is a high-risk moment in time. And so, you know, there's a lot that that the campus can do and the community, the institution can do, but then there's a lot that the community can and needs to do on this. And some of this really does have to do with the regulatory framework for alcohol in the community that sits around a university.
All right. Well, thanks for that call. And we go next to James in Oshkosh. Hi, James.
Hi, how's it going?
Okay, how are you?
I'm doing all right.
And what do you think?
Yeah. I think that drinking has become kind of a big issue on campus. I used to hang out with a group of friends that drinking was the big thing, and especially, I'd say, freshman year up to junior year, I'd say. It was a really big issue. We'd go out 3-4 times a week sometimes, and sometimes it just got out of hand. And, I mean, I've made the right choices now getting on the right track and all, but a couple of my buddies, I mean, I've seen them get 3 or 4 drinking tickets, and it's very damaging, especially, like, when it comes to schoolwork and everything like that, keeping up. It's, I don't know, it's pretty hard.
So, James, do you think looking back that you see it as kind of a rite of passage in what you go through when you go to college and that people grow out of it, or is it something that can actually stick with you for a long time?
I almost kind of see, yeah, it can be like a rite of passage, but at the same time, I used to bartend on Main Street, and it was kind of a big deal, like, even within the community. On that standpoint, it's almost kind of ingrained in the culture, you know, but I guess it almost takes like a certain slap in the face to get you on the right track, you know.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your thoughts on that. And Dr. Van Orman, what do you think about that?
Yeah, those are really good observations. The other thing, this is a little bit hard to get the exact statistics on this, but I think he's right that for many students, they may have high-risk drinking in college, and then as they move into, you know, jobs and things like that, that changes. But we think maybe up to a quarter of students who have high-risk drinking in college go on to develop alcohol dependency problems, more like an alcohol addiction. So that's also very concerning in terms of their long-term health and well-being. So it absolutely, for many students, it's actually not a rite of passage.
All right. Well, thank you for that call. And let's go to Dan next. Dan in Menominee. Hi, Dan.
Hi there.
Hey.
I also happen to be from the Stout area, so I got to see some of the drinking that Steve mentioned. My question for your guest is, do you think that stricter alcohol laws actually prevent drinking, or do you think it just turns it into something that you can only do at a party school?
All right, good question. Thanks, Dan. And Dr. Van Orman?
It's a great question. There is evidence that we know. There's sort of a good colleague of mine who works in this area talks about the kind of 4 levers for alcohol, and it has to do with the ability to get it, the attractiveness, the affordability, and the acceptability. We know that there's pretty good evidence that laws that reduce the ability for people to get alcohol, and that primarily is through increased enforcement of the minimum legal drinking age through sales, through the provision of alcohol, through compliance checks, reduce alcohol-related issues around college campuses. The other issue is simply the cost of alcohol, and we know that Wisconsin has very, very low-cost alcohol because of very low alcohol taxes. Now, those are things that we as a community have to have a conversation about to decide if we know those things, those kinds of changes, might reduce the issue, but there's obviously a cost associated with them. But the most effective things are actually probably reducing the availability of alcohol and increasing the cost of alcohol.
Well, thanks for the call, Dan. Appreciate that. And we just got a really interesting email from an anonymous listener who says, at orientation, before he even started at UW, my son's class was told by the Madison police that they would not be hassled if they were just drinking in their room, minding their own business. The policeman said something like, if you're running down State Street naked, then you're in trouble. And it gave them the clear message that drinking was okay. And goes on to say, another son just started at UWM, and they were basically told the same thing. Although the message they're giving the kids is about drinking safely, the kids laugh it off as getting a free pass to drinking. Although my son is on the dean's list now in his fourth year, I truly wonder about him leaving there next year with a serious drinking problem. What would you say to that parent?
Well, I would say I appreciate you sending that to me, and that's absolutely something that that's not a message your son should have received. So I'm sorry that that happened, and I think, you know, we also need to make sure that we're giving consistent messages. When we look at best practices, that's also exactly one, is to make sure we are giving consistent messages. I think it gets back to one of your earlier points that sometimes it's so easy to laugh about this, even those of us who are in, you know, leadership positions or with the police. It's so easy to make this into a joke, and it's really not. So we also have to do our work better to be consistent about this. So I appreciate that.
You're talking about, you know, your job affiliated with the university, with health services. What would you tell parents that they can do to try to do some preemptive parenting about the drinking that their kids are going to encounter in college before they get to college?
That's such a important role that parents can play in this. So I think it's really important for parents to talk to their students about alcohol. I think they have to set their expectations. And even though a student may not necessarily, they may make their own choices, I think knowing what their parents' expectations are really important. I think you can set expectations at the same time that you help students understand alcohol, and, you know, understand what the minimum, you know, what the blood alcohol content is, understand the effects of alcohol, and help your student really see the connection between how they choose to drink and their long-term goals. You know, if they want to, you know, have a certain GPA or have a certain major or a certain professional career, helping them start to understand at this age that there is a connection between those things. And then I think also having a conversation about some of the safety issues around alcohol and how drinking, particularly a point of incapacitation, really puts them at risk for some of those things. So it's a long conversation. And then the last thing I'd say about the conversation around alcohol is to sort of have it before they start school. And then really those first couple months of they're on campus is when we know students' drinking patterns change quite a bit. So really keep asking them, are you drinking? How much? Talking to them about it.
So keep the conversation going even when they're in college.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, Dr. Van Orman, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for talking about this important area.
We've been talking to Dr. Sarah Van Orman, Executive Director of University Health Services at UW-Madison.
Coming up next, we'll wax nostalgic about one of the coolest school supplies of all time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Riggert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.